Conspiracy against the United States, money laundering, lying to the FBI. We've got the latest on the charges from the special counsel's office with our legal analyst, Roger Wolfson.
And conservative analyst, Dr. Christopher Metzler, is here to talk about the opioid crisis and what the White House plans to do about it.
Happy Halloween. It's October 31st. Welcome to the Political Beat.
You're tuning into the destination for TV superfan discussion, AfterBuzz TV. And now, let the buzz begin.
Hey guys, welcome to AfterBuzz TV's The Political Beat, the millennial show and podcast, bringing you the latest from things from around the world and around the country. I'm your host, Drexel Hurd, the semi-moderate voice of the left. You can follow me on Twitter at Drexel Hurd.
And I'm Chelsea Galicia, the lefter of the left at Chelsea Galicia.
Be sure to follow the show at Political Beat TV on Twitter. First off, our thoughts are with the folks of New York City after today's terror attack. 8 confirmed dead in downtown New York City. Also, open enrollment starts tomorrow. Very important. I know the Trump administration does not want you to know that, but be sure to sign up or make your healthcare changes and let your friends and family know. First up on the show today, we'll start with our interview with Dr. Christopher Metzler on the opioid epidemic.
And in the breakdown, we'll talk about the indictments with our legal analyst, Roger Wolfson.
And as it is the last day of October, we'll spotlight highlight our last breast cancer organization that's helping millions of women across the country during Breast Cancer Awareness Month. I do not know what is happening today. Can I talk?
You're just so excited.
I am very excited today, but I'm not excited to talk about this. 64,000 Americans died of drug overdoses. Overdoses last year. And a huge contributor of that has to do with the rising and dangerous opioid epidemic that takes the lives of at least 90 Americans a day. When I was writing this, and I was like, 90 Americans a day is crazy to me. According to the Health and Human Services website, providers wrote nearly a quarter of a billion opioid prescriptions in 2013 with a wide variation across the states. This is enough for every adult to have their own bottle of pills. Mm-hmm. Both congressional Democrats and Republicans have been speaking out in states across the country to talk about how opioids are affecting their constituents, with the Trump administration declaring a public health emergency and creating a federal task force to address what's going on. So here to discuss this is conservative analyst and president of Gordium Healthcare Drug Rehab Clinic, Dr. Christopher Metzler. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You are the first conservative on this show.
Oh, wow. His first being made.
And hopefully the
Welcome.
Last. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
Welcome. So now every Republican or conservative that ever tweets at me, why didn't you have Republicans on this show? Well, today is happening. History is happening in this room right now.
Yes. Well, who needs a conservative to bring the fireworks when you and I, with the left and lefter thing, bring enough of it on our own?
I know. If this was a few years ago, maybe I would have brought my conservative bona fides.
Uh-huh.
Not even conservative. Republicans bona fides. It's very different. People don't understand there's a difference between Republicans and conservatives. I was a rhino. Okay. Let's talk about opioids. Dr. Metzler, how did we get here? What's going on?
What we had is essentially we had doctors over-prescribing for pain. The way that this works is you start off with pain, whether it's back pain or some other body pain. The doctors were prescribing things like oxycodone, OxyContin. Those two drugs in particular were being prescribed. They were being over-prescribed. If you look at a state, for example, the state of Florida, Pam Bundy, the attorney general, cracked down on that. There were the so-called pill mills, where what doctors were doing is they were just giving people prescriptions. You had doctors who were being paid for prescriptions. As a result of that, people became addicted. Once that happened, since there was the crackdown, they couldn't get it anymore. So then you went to this whole thing. The two most, the two deadliest drugs probably at this point are fentanyl, and though not really a prescribed opioid, you have heroin, and that's a very deadly combination.
Interesting. So I was reading the New York Times yesterday. Opioid in this article said opioids on the quad. Mm-hmm. We're a millennial show, and it was a great article that really talked about things that are happening on college campuses.
Yeah.
Students are getting addicted, starting with things like Percocet and recreational drugs like heroin that you just talked about.
Recreational drugs like heroin. Heroin has just now dropped down to the same level as marijuana or something.
Yeah.
Man, things have changed since I was in college.
We were talking about the show. I said, I didn't even know this drug conversation is so new to me because I just did not grow up in that world. So I have no idea. So this is a really interesting conversation. I'm glad we're talking about it today. Can you talk about what you've seen at Gordium Healthcare and why millennials may be turning to these sort of drugs? Is it pressure? Is it...
It's
what's
fun,
happening?
Drexel. Don't you know?
Oh, it's
that?
Fun. Oh,
I don't know. I'm just assuming, right?
Yeah. Well, they do report to us that it's fun, but besides that, it is peer pressure. You have a lot of peer pressure. You also have to look at the fact that in a lot of these homes, millennials were raised by TV. They were raised by the internet, and so you have a lot of friends back and forth. Hey, why don't you try this drug? Why don't you try that? It's not that bad, that kind of stuff. And so that's what we've seen in a lot of cases. And so by the time the parents decide that they're going to crack down, it's too late because the addiction has come into play. They then have to check into rehab.
See, millennials are lazy. With marijuana and all that stuff, you got to find a drug dealer.
Yeah.
For this, you just go to your parents' medicine cabinet.
Yes.
And that's how it starts.
So this might be a stupid question because we've talked about oxycodone before the show started. We've talked about Percocet. We've talked about just any sort of painkillers. A lot of young people are also dropping ecstasy.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a gateway into this?
Not really, because it's the whole origin of this is pain. You remember when you had a lot of the ambulance chasing lawyers, so you had a lot of them who were involved in car accidents, that kind of stuff, and so everybody had pain. They had neck pain, they had back pain, they had all of those kinds of things. Pharmaceutical industry realizes that and then decides that what they're going to do is cure pain.
Right. So that's why I'm confused, because if students are not in pain, students in college, like what are they in
you
pain?
You can get a wisdom tooth pulled.
Yeah.
You can break a bone. You can just tell the doctor, I have back pain. And these pharmaceutical companies have deals with doctors where they make it very readily available.
Well, and that's exactly right. And that's the whole thing, because, you can't, a lot of this pain, the doctor can't really diagnose. I mean,
right.
The question becomes, do I have pain? The doctor can't really tell you.
There's
you
no
don't
test.
Have pain. Yeah, there's no test that can do that.
So now the White House is going to be the hero, I guess, of the opioid crisis. What do you think of the plan, I should use air quotes, that seems to be coming out of the White House?
Well, there really is no plan that's coming out of the White House.
That's
essentially, what you have is you have the president creating a task force. It's like another Blue Ribbon Commission. There's no funds attached to that. And so what essentially the president was pressured into doing is to say, we're going to take care of this, and I'm going to declare a national health emergency. Let's look back historically of the number of national health emergencies that came into play and nothing really happened. This is something that has to happen at the state level. It has to happen in the homes. That's the kind of stuff. So, yeah, I guess the White House is raising awareness of it. That's not effective.
So does it feel to you like lip service? There's really no teeth in whatever they're...
No.
I mean, because the fund, apparently, that they have access to when he declared it... I get confused between the national emergency and a health emergency.
Yeah.
It's really like $57,000 deep. That's about all it's got.
And that's about all it's going to get.
And so as I'm very fascinated, as your conservative outlook, you believe that the how we're going to fix this is in the home and the states.
Yes.
Do you think that there's any role in regulating the pharmaceutical companies who've been
absolutely
pushing this? And like the main investor, like 70% investor of Insys, the company that had the spray fentanyl, he was just indicted last week. And do you think it's going to matter, or he'll go down for pushing something to people that he knows shouldn't be having this. I mean, the drug was supposed to be for people dying of cancer.
Yeah.
And then it got pushed to, like, everybody and their mother. So is an individual like that, A, you think, going to get convicted? And is that going to help the pharmaceutical companies slow their roll?
Yeah, I think I think he probably will be convicted. But as it relates to the pharmaceutical companies, the issue is not regulation as much as it is the strength of the regulation. That's the difficulty with the pharmaceutical companies, because the regulations themselves really have no teeth, really. They end up going after small community pharmacies, and the large guys, you know, get a pass, in large part because you look at the financial contributions that a number of the pharmaceutical companies make to not only the presidential race, but also to state and local races.
All right, Drexel, here, the first time in history of this show that I was not the one to bring up money in politics.
No, which is good. Listen, we like to joke a lot about. Listen, I think that everybody understands that money in politics is really a problem. We just have a difference of opinion on how to spend that money and how to raise that money just a little bit. So I have a question on, as we talk about money, an economic issue. Do you think that this problem is an economic issue? And I say that by saying, I preface that with, who do you think is more affected by this? Poorer Americans, richer Americans? Is it a combination of both? Is it the millennials that come from rich households? Is it, like, where is the spectrum? Is there a spectrum?
Yeah, well, I can tell you what we see. What we see tends to be the richer Americans. That's what we tend to see. You know, we tend to see the folks who can afford to get the drugs from wherever they're getting it from. And we also see a lot of the parents who themselves have become addicted to these drugs and who, you know, just kind of leave them laying around at home.
And I was talking earlier about an article that I saw before we went on the air, an article that I saw about the difference in race.
Yes.
And you agreed with the article that I was telling about, which that black people are affected less by this,
right,
because of straight racism by doctors prescribing medication, believing that black people are more likely to, I don't know, sell, abuse it.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, there are a number of studies that talk about how differently blacks experience pain. A lot of physicians don't buy those studies, and you know, race is a factor. The issue of disparity in healthcare in America is nothing new.
Mm-hmm.
As much as, you know, people like to say, well, you know, you're always bringing up the issue of race, I'm bringing up the issue of science, you know, and the impact, disparate impact as it relates to healthcare and the quality of healthcare is scientifically proven. It's not a political question.
So I'm not playing identity politics by pointing out that this is actual, you know,
no,
about
that's,
the
right.
incidence
that's what the
of
research says.
So,
black and brown.
So speaking of healthcare, so you've got a rehabilitation. You've got a healthcare center.
Yeah.
A drug rehab clinic. Can you tell us a little bit about what that rehabilitation is like for folks that are addicted to opioids? And like an example of a program that people have to go through,
sure,
that maybe at your clinic.
Yeah. So what generally happens is they will come in and there is a very intense process at the clinic of getting to know individually each of the patients that come in, because there's so many factors. One of the most important factors that we have to treat immediately is issues of nutrition. Because in a lot of cases, they will come in there. You know, we have a chef that prepares meals and all of those kinds of things. But for the first 24 hours or so, they're not eating anything. And they're not eating in large part because all they've been doing is taking drugs. At this point, they got to the point where they say, enough's enough. And, you know, that's what they've been doing. So you have that first. You have to take all of their possessions from them. Everything. Even if they bring medication in, we cannot allow them to take that medication. The bottle may say one thing, the contents may be another. Mm-hmm. You then have to go into the urinalysis component of this. And a lot of times people say, well, it's very invasive because you cannot, you know, piss in a cup, so to speak, without having one of our techs there watching you do that, because we don't know what it is that you're going to do. You're allowed 3 pieces of clothing. That's it. Everything else is locked in lockers. We then go through things like group therapy. Make it a very supportive environment. You have to have psychiatrists. You have to have really a comprehensive team of people to treat the whole person rather than simply treating the symptom. The symptom obviously would be the overdose. The question is, how do you get people not to relapse? And that's what we do.
Well, what is the rate of relapse?
It depends. Rate of relapse can be as low as 15%. It can go as high as 60 or 70%. And that's why the individual treatment is so important, and getting to know the person is so important. One of our competitors had a situation in which they had this guy who walked in and said, I'm addicted, and they did not do the process like we do. What ended up happening is this guy was a drug dealer. So he came in and said to all of the patients, look, based on how much money you're paying here, come with me down the street. I have all the drugs you want. And so they lost probably a couple hundred patients who simply walked out because, we don't hold them hostage, so they can leave at any time.
So are you surprised that that Donald Trump didn't make some sort of we need to, crack down and law and order approach to this, and that it's like a health approach to this that he's sort of kind of taking?
Not really, because I think, what he would say is, well, we leave that up to the state attorneys general and law enforcement to decide. The federal government's not in the business of this. So it doesn't surprise me. And as I said, looking at the declaration of this health emergency, national crisis, et cetera, it's great PR, but at this point, that's all it is.
I would also think that he probably didn't want to crack down on the children and the friend of his friends, as that probably would have.
Right. I mean, that's the other interesting thing. Like, the reaction to this by the government is very different from the crack epidemic.
And, yeah.
So how do you, as a conservative, believe that we can sort of pay for all the people that need treatment, because there are, I don't know, millions of people that need treatment for this, and their Obamacare is not going to cover it. I mean, what do you think should be done to handle this health-wise and fiscally responsibly?
And I'm going to piggyback on that, because I was going to ask the tax question as the Trump administration, as the House, unveils their tax plan on Thursday, and the Trump administration has unveiled their tax plan. They're looking to cut taxes. You have a private healthcare clinic. Mm-hmm. Chelsea's talking about, can hospitals, if they don't have the money to do that, how do you think that it should be a private thing? Do you think that hospitals, like from an economic standpoint, if hospitals aren't getting money from the taxpayers,
hospitals are figuring out how to get money.
Yeah, the hospitals are figuring out how to get the money. But here's the thing. This is not one of those things that can be completely privatized. Could we look at something like a public-private partnership? Absolutely, because here's what's in it for the private sector folks. You're not losing employees. You're not losing their children. So from that standpoint, I think this has to be solved by a combination of a public-private partnership. But if something is not done about this, we are, in fact, going to end up bailing out the hospitals. I mean, and that's my biggest concern, is that because when people OD and stuff, they're going to go to the emergency room. That's
right.
What they're going to do. Right. So that's
and
the reality.
And
we're not going to let these hospitals go down.
No.
I mean,
right.
If we didn't let GM go down.
We're not going to let the hospitals
go down. It's going to be a hospital bailout.
And that's exactly right. And that's going to be worse than the auto bailout.
Right. That's a good conversation. I mean, I feel like we could talk about this whole conversation, especially for our age group, because obviously it's, I feel like it's hitting millennials a little bit more than some other people. So thank you for having that conversation with us.
My pleasure.
Stick around for a second because we're going to get your thoughts on Robert Mueller in just a second. So yesterday.
Yes.
I don't even know where to start. Manafort Monday, they called it. I call it Treason Tuesday. That's today.
I saw somebody said, it was some sort of silly thing that I saw online, something different from it's Mueller time.
It's Mueller time. That's funny.
Did you see that?
I did see that.
There was something else, and it just came and went from my mind.
So yesterday, as we all know, indictments came down from the special counsel's office. So first, we want to kind of explain what an indictment is. So I'm just going to kind of read it so that I'm getting it pretty clear.
People don't know what an indictment is.
A formal accusation that a person has committed a crime. An indictment can only be presented after presenting evidence to a grand jury made up of us, who must be convinced that based on the evidence, wrongdoing occurred enough to warrant the charges. Yesterday, the Office of Special Counsel, run by FBI Director Robert Mueller, indicted former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort and former Manafort campaign deputy Rick Gates on 12 counts. So we're going to run through this really quickly. Conspiracy against the United States, which I think is a huge.
I saw somebody put, who among us hasn't been accused of conspiracy against the United States?
According to John Kelly, it's definitely not the folks in the Civil War. Conspiracy to launder money was count two. Counts three through six, failure to file reports of foreign bank and financial accounts for calendar years 2011, 2014. Count seven through nine, same thing.
Different years.
Count 10, unregistered agent of a foreign principal, which is really interesting because there's been plenty Trump associates who have not done that so far. And count 11, false and misleading FARA statement, which is the Foreign Agents Registration Act. And count 12, false statements, which at this point, Sarah Huckabee Sanders and the rest of the Trump administration probably should hire a lawyer.
Except that this is false statements to the FBI. Apparently, you can tell false statements to the American people all day long. Indictments.
I'm pretty sure they've been telling false statements to the FBI, too. What's more damning probably was the guilty plea by former Trump campaign foreign policy advisor and oil and gas executive George Papadopoulos. Papadopoulos pled guilty in October. Earlier this month, to lying to FBI about his conversations with people linked to the Russian government about potential dirt on Hillary Clinton.
I like the air quotes.
Yeah, because it's air quotes in here on Hillary Clinton and Russia's openness to cooperation with the campaign. He was arrested back in July. So from July until now,
he's good at keeping.
Something's been going on.
Good at keeping secrets.
In the Papadopoulos case. On page 8, I'm just going to read because there was a...
I love watching you be like a little legal geek.
Listen,
here.
Listen, I just want to read this because this is really interesting. I texted Chelsea last night.
I thought I was
like
the only one that enjoyed reading these.
I do. It's crazy. I said it read like a John Grisham novel. The government notes, is on page 8, the government notes that the official forwarded defendant Papadopoulos' email to another campaign official stated, quote, let's discuss. We need someone to communicate that DT, Donald Trump, is not doing these trips. It should be someone low level in the campaign so as not to send any signal.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty sure somebody on the campaign knew. And even though they're trying to pretend like this guy was low level. And B, that Donald Trump knew because they didn't want to send him overseas. So let's start there. Following his arrest, there's another page that says defendant met with government on numerous occasions to provide information and answer questions. That's from July into now, which possibly means that he was wearing a wire for the last couple of months. Paul Manafort and Rick Gates both pled not guilty and are being held on house arrest on a $10 million and a $5 million bond. Whew, that was all yesterday, and that was just Monday. So let's get some opinions on this. Here to discuss more with us is our pal, legal analyst, and I just realized he's a commissioner here in Los Angeles. Roger Wolfson. Roger Wolfson, welcome back, sir.
So good to be back. Thank you.
So quick thoughts on this indictment from yesterday.
Well, if you look in the context of history and American history, this is a very exciting position that we're in right now, but it's not the first time. You know, I think that and one of the things that really concerns me, and I think should concern every American, is the response of the men at the top. And whether Trump is going to fire Mueller is the big question for me, and whether he can. You know, if I put my legal hat on and I look at the way that Mueller is behaving, I'm very impressed by his organization. He's very much of a Drexel. I mean, he's got everything out on the table. He's really looking at this carefully. I think a large part of how he's moving around is to avoid a situation where Trump feels like he has to fire him. You know, I think that one of the reasons why he announced Manafort first and really went out with that, and it's the former campaign manager and all the allegations against Manafort and Gates don't necessarily connect to Trump. I think there's a reason for that. I think that if he came right out of the gate and the first things were already at your doorstep, Trump, I think that that would probably push Trump's hand.
He would freak out and fire him.
Right.
But because he can distance himself from Manafort and Gates, he doesn't feel
less threatened. Well, at least they're going to try. But to your point on the Robert Mueller, on the firing of Robert Mueller,
yes.
Do you think, A, that would be smart? Because, I mean, I feel like that's a rhetorical question.
About as smart as firing Comey.
But do you think that Eric Schneiderman or any of the state's attorneys generals will file dual charges sometime this week to kind of protect? Because the House has there's a bipartisan bill in the House right now that is set to protect Robert Mueller. I don't even know that there's nothing on the docket that says this bill is going to the floor anytime soon. But we do know that Robert Mueller and Eric Schneiderman have been having conversations. Do you think that that is going to be something that we're going to see in the next couple of days? Maybe it was dependent on Trump's reaction. Where Eric Schneiderman says, okay, now I need to file these charges to make sure that the president cannot pardon these people.
Well, I do think that if you look at a lot of Mueller's charges and the way he's behaving, I think that he's looking for all the cover and protection he can get. So as your audience probably knows, the president can only pardon federal crimes.
Right.
A lot of the crimes that we're talking about here that are even in the indictment are New York State-based at the very least, if not other states. And if you look at the real issue, the fact that Donald Trump hired Manafort in the first place, what Manafort is known for is this type of stuff. So it's not like Trump can go and say, oh, I'm surprised, I'm shocked by this. I mean, that's why Trump wanted him. Trump's history is a very lengthy one of him being involved with very shady characters, doing very shady things. He's even bragged about it himself as it being smart and good for business. I mean, he's bragged about his tax evasion as it being good business.
Right.
So I don't think there's necessarily surprises here. You know, I think that the way that Mueller has weighed this in a very clever way is that if he can keep the balance nice and easy so that there isn't something on the front burner that's so scary to Trump that he's got to let him go, then Trump's calculus then becomes how much damage will I do if I do fire the guy.
Right.
And I think that, you know, Trump from day one, I think even before he was elected, has always had one calculation, keeping my base happy. If he can keep his base happy, he's not going anywhere, at least until the Democrats have a majority in one of the houses.
Right.
What do you say to people who are like, this, you know, Manafort, he's a shady businessman, but what does this have to do with Trump, and how is this at all connected to Trump and Russia? Do you see a connection?
Well, I do, in part because, you know, understanding the legal process, and this is great. One of the things I love about this show is how much you guys educate your audience and don't necessarily assume they know everything, because that's one of the things that offends me sometimes about reading the papers is they assume a knowledge that even I don't have sometimes.
Right.
And I don't say that to brag, but you know, I read the paper a lot. But getting back to it, so when you're building an indictment, what you're trying to do is you're trying to build a steady case. You're trying to go after low-level people, get them to turn like Papadopoulos, and I'm so grateful that Papadopoulos is involved because I love saying his name. but, you know, you want to get him, and you want to get them out there with wires potentially. Now, probably my guess is because they've announced that Papadopoulos may or may not have been wearing a wire, every single conversation in the whole town of Washington is going to be different from today on. That's mm-hmm. the biggest change, by the way, mm-hmm. in Washington, D.C., is everyone's afraid of the wire. That said, you want to basically build a case so that you can start turning people and go higher and higher. I'm not the least bit surprised that the type of people they're going after are not Jared Kushner, you know, or Don Jr., because those are the last people who are going to turn against their dad.
Right.
They're going around, and they're doing it steadily and methodically with, I think, a degree of maturity. It's very hard to say that Mueller froths at the mouth. It's very hard to say he's partisan since he's a Republican. You know, it's very hard to make the kind of arguments that Trump needs to. So I think right now Trump is in a situation where they've given him enough air to breathe so that he can say the kind of things that he's saying by, you know, by tweet that, you know, oh, keep focusing on Hillary, keep focusing on Hillary, which is only really going to his base because only his base is necessarily caring about that. And that gives Mueller enough room to go out there and keep building his case like a good solid Drexel.
So
I think he thinks he would be a good lawyer.
You know what? I probably
I'm always surprised to find out he isn't.
So the Papadopoulos Papadopoulos filing. Apparently there was a Papadopoulos back in the Nixon era too. There was a George Papadopoulos
was there
back
really?
Then. I mean, somebody can Google it. I read somewhere that there was a George Papadopoulos in the Nixon era.
And by the way, he is not related to George Stephanopoulos.
George Stephanopoulos, right. Oh my goodness, I might now say George Stephanopoulos if we did that. It mentions a top campaign advisor and a campaign supervisor. We know that Sam Clovis, who is now in the U.S. in the Department of Agriculture, he was also nominated to be the top science advisor, which he has no science background. Do you guys think that the top campaign advisor, and this could Chelsea Roger, do you guys think the top campaign advisor was Carter Page, who was on MSNBC last night?
Oh, I missed that.
Yapping his mouth to Chris Hayes blew my mind last night. I was like, the stuff that this guy is saying right now, he was saying, I might have emailed about Russia. I might have talked to, like, the stuff that he was saying, I was like, who coached this guy to go on television and just yap his mouth on national television about an ongoing investigation?
No lawyer told him to.
He said he's got outside lawyers and friends that are talking. I don't know.
Carter Page. Nobody that can keep a leash on that guy.
Crazy. You have to watch it. You have to go back and watch this interview from last night if you haven't watched it because it's nuts. Carter Page, Jared Kushner, or Don Jr.? Top campaign, because like I feel like it can't be Paul Manafort. That doesn't seem like they could have put Manafort's name in this filing if it was Paul Manafort.
My feeling is that we're going to hear some names we just haven't heard yet. You know, I think it might be Carter. I just don't think all these people are luring up. I don't know if Carter would have been on the news last night if he suspects that he's the one that they're talking about. Because if I'm his lawyer, I'm saying you lay low right now.
That's what Chris Hayes said last night. He said, "I really hope, for your sake, from everything that you've said tonight, that you're really innocent." Like, because the stuff that he was surprised the shit out of Chris Hayes last night, too. All right. So I want to get everybody, Dr. Mesler, I want to get everybody's opinion on this. What do you guys think of the White House response? Because we're going to throw up Donald Trump's tweet from yesterday. Trump tweeted, sorry, but this was years ago, before Paul Manafort was part of the Trump campaign. But why aren't crooked Hillary and the Dems the focus? And then he also tweeted also, because he doesn't know how to use ellipses, there was no collusion, in all caps.
I thought it was a very presidential answer.
Yeah, that reminds me of the tweet that he had the other day that said, while not presidential. I think every tweet that should start with, while not presidential. Sarah Huckabee Sanders tried to downplay the role of Papadopoulos played in the campaign, which is completely different from this filing, and using the same line that they used on Paul Manafort, which was the very limited role in the campaign. So what do you guys think of that White House response?
Should I give you a chance to please jump in?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I don't know why the White House would be saying anything at this point about this. To me, the message should have been nothing. The indictments have been issued. We'll see where this is going. Moving on.
Should have pulled Paul Ryan.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's what Paul did, exactly what should be done. And, you know, Sarah, I'm really not understanding that podium. There is
what does that
you and the
do
rest
to
of America.
Yeah, I mean, because I don't know what it does to people.
She's
maybe
not
there's
CJ
opioids
Craig.
In it.
Oh, is that what it
maybe
is?
Maybe there's opioids in it.
Because, that's funny. I mean, she stands up there and I'm like, Sarah, really? You're lying.
Right. And it's really crazy because, like, she's like, we've watched Republican press secretaries get up there. Dana Perino,
yeah.
Tony Snow, even, what's his name?
Ari Fleischer.
Yeah. And Ari's a little crazy now. If you follow him on Twitter, he's a little crazy now. And who was Bush had one. I can't remember his name. But, like, they are very different than Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Even for the most part, Sean Spicer was a little bit more cautious about things that he says. But Sarah Huckabee Sanders straight up lying, because you know what I think it is? She's just like her dad. Governor Huckabee. Yeah. I mean, they're basically, he's cut from the same cloth. So, So Roger, what do you think about the White House response?
Well, you know, this is Now, I like the fact that we have a conservator because it reminds me that you have a bipartisan audience and you really like to take people behind the curtain. And this is really a show for millennials, and you're teaching them about this process. This is what I think. I think that what probably happened in the campaign was totally inappropriate. It was illegal and it was treasonous because we have very strong lines between how you're allowed to let foreign governments get involved in domestic policy and elections. But to me, what Trump should be attacked for is what he's about to put out to the American public, what he's currently doing. He's doing enough to the American public right now with this tax bill, with his appointments to the court, with his appointment, with everything he's doing on a policy bit, which we're not paying any attention to at all, to warrant an impeachment and an impeachment-level attacks. What he's just doing with these tweets and what he's even doing with this investigation right now is – look at all this, pay attention to all this, and in the meantime, I'm doing permanent damage to the fabric of this nation. That's how I see it as
well. So on that, politically, there's clearly a lot on the table that's happening, but that's got to happen between now and basically Thanksgiving.
Right.
Tax reform. They want to do welfare reform because Sarah Huckabee Sanders got that question yesterday from April Ryan. Federal judges that Mitch McConnell has pulled the blue slip away from basically the entire Senate. Do you guys think that this is going to have an effect on the agenda? This, and I'm talking about this as in the indictment piece of it, is going to have an effect on this agenda, or is it just going to embolden them to move faster?
I think that as long as the public's attention is on what is Mueller doing, what Mueller isn't doing, which is a process that no matter what, if Mueller were to admit it right now, he'd say this is going to take years. It's going to take years. What's happening right now is so much more important and has such a much larger impact on everyday Americans, on everybody who's watching the show right now. These tax policies, the cuts to Pell Grants, the cuts to every program of social welfare, the amount of money that's now being spent on the military, these increases, these are of profound long-term significance. And we can't pay attention to them because we're caring about, issues that are just, in our eye, the constant flashes of things. So it is a very intelligent strategy. I'm not even certain that I would say that Trump is doing it intentionally, but it works because we pay attention to we pay attention to this and we don't even notice what's going on behind the curtain. And that's the stuff that is going to permanently damage the fabric of this nation.
So in that, because I want to talk about the Democrats for a second, because the Democrats have their own problem in Tony Podesta. Or at least it seems like they're going to have a problem with Tony Podesta. I want to talk briefly about that piece of it in terms of what the Democratic response should be, because we all know on this show how critical I am of the Democratic messaging because it's pretty terrible.
You're not alone.
And so should Democrats be out there? How should Democrats be going around the country
saying,
right now?
I told you so? Well, isn't that always the best thing to do? I'm totally kidding.
But I mean, like, is it going around talking about policy and getting out there every day? Should Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, Bernie was in New York with Mayor de Blasio yesterday. Keith Ellison put out a thing today that talked about talking about the Republican tax plan. But I also felt like in that, Keith Ellison should have also said, because I watched that 5-minute video or whatever, that he also should have said, but here's our plan. Why is it never, here's our plan? Why is it, here's the attack on it? Because if you're saying we need to be talking about what the Republicans are doing, why is it that Democrats can't seem to go, here's what's happening, bad, 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 and here's our plan? Why is it never, here's our plan?
Well, the reason why there isn't here our plan is, first of all,
there is no plan.
Having been a Senate staffer, as you know, I was chief counsel to four different senators, or counsel or speechwriter as well. And the majority has a lot more money for staff. They're able to hold hearings. They're able to they have the first attention of legislative counsel, which is on all the resources around them to be able to put this together. Putting together a tax plan is not something you can even do in the minority. So it's not like the Democrats can just go easily and say, this is our plan, because it's a big process.
Well, maybe not so much
here's
the
what
Senate.
We do differently.
Maybe not so much the leaders in the Senate. Maybe the DNC or the DCCC, these other
Nobody
arms.
Likes the DNC right now. But I don't think the DNC is going to do the Democrats any favor.
But I
by
think that
out.
They would, and to the Keith Ellison video point.
Yeah.
I believe that there was an opportunity for Democrats to start the conversation this week as Republicans are start to unveil their tax plan, for Democrats to say, for Keith or for Tom or for somebody to get out there and say, but here's the Democratic alternative to that. We saw 7-8 years where Republicans said, we have a plan to repeal and replace Obamacare. Here's, and then no plan came. If Democrats start to go down that path of let's just talk about what's bad about the Republican tax plan without offering an alternative tax plan early, while people are paying attention to what's happening, or while people are not paying attention to where they can go back and say, hey, we talked about this last year. If they don't start now and going into 2018, people are going to be like, what is wrong? I mean, that's off topic of this whole thing, but it's just crazy.
I really respect what you're saying, and in an ideal universe, that would be great. But let's say you're Keith Ellison, okay, who is an incredible guy and incredibly magnetic and very communicative. Every time you speak, you know that if you get a shot at the news, it's going to be maybe 30 seconds.
Right.
And the first thing that anyone's going to want to hear you talk about is Trump, because that's what's always going to lead. So that's already taken up 15 of your seconds. You've got 15 seconds left. Do you attack a Republican tax plan that really has an excellent chance of passing? An excellent chance of passing, which you need to do, or do you just say, okay, I don't have room or time to talk about tax plan. Here's what I would do when nobody cares what you're going to do. Right. When you would have a chance of passing anything.
Right, but it's really
just about how much oxygen there is and how much you can comment on, and everyone's fighting for this much because Trump is taking all of it.
Right, yeah, but we also saw that during the campaign. We also saw Hillary Clinton put out pages of policy papers, and people are like, well, I don't even know what her policies were.
Right.
And you're like, but that's all she talked about the entire time was policy, and nobody – so like – Democrats, I feel like, should not be afraid to be like, nope, we're going to be explainers.
I want to hear what the conservative has to say about what we should be doing.
And here's the thing for me. What Democrats really can learn from conservatives on the issue of messaging, we may be loud, we may be wrong, but we're consistent.
I'm glad that you said wrong and consistent at the same time. You're right.
And that's the thing. So when our messages come out, we keep repeating the same thing over and over again.
I know. How is it that you guys do that? Do you like brainwash them all? I mean, what's the deal?
Well, it's good messaging points. It's good surrogates. It's all of those kinds of things. And so you got to be loud. You can be wrong. It doesn't matter. Clearly, we're wrong because now we were supposed to repeal Obamacare and we had nothing. But we were consistent.
Right.
And that's the thing. I feel like Democrats are just all over the place on these issues. So given that short time that you have, I think those message points, I think that's the breakthrough.
We have three talking points on every issue, and
that's it.
Right. Well, it's to me, that's really worth speaking to, and I appreciate the forthrightness. The reason that I would say it works out like that is because from my standpoint, again, I'm biased because I'm liberal. Is that the conservative message is they're representing a moneyed small interest, you know, and that a lot of the libertarian element, too, are against the government, so they're able to fall into that interest, and a lot of people who are probably, you know, who might mostly be Democratic voters who end up conservative also are attracted to the message of capitalism and the like,
right.
But they have a very limited message, so it's easier to everybody agree. The Democratic Party represents, I think, a much larger tent, you know, a much larger number of views, and not all of them even agree with each other. So it's a lot harder to corral those people.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is a lot harder to corral. Absolutely, I agree with that. But until Democrats are able to do that, Democrats are going to be in a messaging deficit. And that messaging deficit then leads to losing elections, and that's the issue. You know, at some point, people are going to have to decide what they're going to give up. In the Trump election, a lot of conservatives said, okay, I'm going to vote for him because I don't care about anything else. I care about the courts. I care, you know, so at some point, you have to give something up.
It's almost like we watched the conventions last year, and it's the old adage, you know, Democrats fall in love, Republicans fall in line. And you look at the way that the Republican convention happened last year and how quickly Republicans who would have never voted for Donald Trump fell in line so fast.
Yep.
And they were just like, okay, yep, we're going to win. That's it. End of story. Hillary Clinton's out. She's going to lose, whatever. And Democrats got in there and it just – you're like, how could Republicans fall in line behind Donald Trump? You know,
and we all couldn't do the same for Hillary.
Well, not even and like it's like, okay, we see who we're up against. She's already the nominee. And this could be anybody, whether or not whoever won, it should have been like, we got a lockstep because the guy on the other side is pretty terrible. And they seem to be falling in line.
To me, it goes right back to the point I was making, which is that with the Republican, the core constituency have a very small number of shared views. And they're able to do that, so whoever's going to propagate those views and represent them, they're okay with. With Democrats, because we're so diverse, we need somebody who's a strong leader with a lot of charisma to bring us all together. That's why you've got Obama and Clinton, incredibly charismatic people. No, few people.
Bill Clinton, by the way, he's not talking about Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, well, Bill Clinton.
You know, I just want to point that out.
On the Republican side, I mean, even though you could say Trump is not that different in his own way than George W. Bush or even Ronald Reagan, who was best known, and he'd been two-term governor of California, but he was a B actor. Right. He was somebody who nobody really took that seriously. We were making the same jokes about him in some ways that we made about Trump. You know, so
I was going to ask you, because you were in the Senate in the Bill Clinton years,
yeah,
and you were around during the impeachment.
I was,
time.
Yeah.
So I don't know what it's like for staffers, like leading up to it, like what you think they might be feeling right now or what it might be like?
It's a great question. I remember it very well. I mean, first of all, you know, you get used to being insulated when you're a staffer, either in the White House or in the Senate or the House. You get used to being insulated. You're the first one in the news. You know what's going to be on the headlines that night, and you're protected from it. You feel like you're secure. And the second it gets to something like an impeachment where it's coming to you, where it's going to be in your house, on your door, where you have to be on the floor and people are looking at the behavior of people like you, it's incredibly nerve-wracking. Because all of a sudden that security that you're built on is now being disrupted. And the fact, you know, that you think what's going to be on the news that night, and no longer you might be in the news that night and you don't even know what's going to be said, it's really unsettling.
And so I would assume it's more unsettling now that staffers who may or may not have interaction with this George Papadopoulos guy with a wire, they're really probably freaking out right now.
Let's put it this way. There's going to be a lot of opiate use in Washington.
So I have a question. Because I'm looking at Paul Manafort's indictment real quick. I want to get your last reaction on this. So on this thing, it says description indictment B. That means there's an indictment A.
Right.
What is indictment A? Because there's seven other sealed indictments out there right now. This is just like, this is apparently, according to the special counsel's office, George Papadopoulos was a small fish in a big pond that they're going after. And this is just, is this part one of two of Paul Manafort's indictment?
What that is to me, now everybody in the political world speaks in some level of code.
Yes.
Everyone speaks in code. That is, I think, Manafort's tiny little fire across the bow. You know, I completely believe that was intentional.
So you think that indictment B, that's based on just taxes, that indictment A of B is the big kahuna?
I really do, and I think it's really smart. And I think that's also that way. That's Mueller's way of sort of signaling a few people, hey, if you're worried because we're not going anywhere to Trump, you know, give us some time.
Crazy. Mm. Well, listen, we're going to leave that right there because this is just part one.
This is part B.
This is part B of this conversation because it is going to go on for so long. Thank you both for coming on and talking about this. I do want to point out, because I was going to talk about, we were talking about these gubernatorial races next week. If you're in Virginia or New Jersey next week, next Tuesday is your election. Make sure you're getting out to vote. You can vote early. You can vote now. You can vote absentee.
Especially if you're in Virginia.
Especially if you're in Virginia.
Oh, my
because
God.
Ralph Northam is running neck and neck with Ed Gillespie, who used to be the former chairman of the Republican Party. Mm. He is pretty terrible. Actually, he's not as bad as Chemtrails Kim in New Jersey, but he is pretty bad. So we will definitely be watching those races between Ralph Northam in Virginia and Phil Murphy in New Jersey. And our guest from a couple of weeks ago, who's running for Detroit City Clerk, his election's next week as well.
Oh, so we gotta look, because that guy is a rock star.
Yeah, he's running for Congress. You heard it here first. Mm-hmm. So be watching out for those, and we'll have all the latest on that next week.
All right. And our last spotlight on Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Very quickly, we wanted to focus on the Breast Cancer Research Foundation, whose mission it is to prevent and cure breast cancer by advancing the world's most promising research, which I think, well, anyways, I was about to put in my own commentary about prevention, but this is not a time to talk about becoming vegan. So check out bcrf.org for more information.
Yeah, I don't even know what November is. November will have a whole nother prevention month, I'm sure. Hmm. I don't know what November is. We'll figure it out. As always, we love viewer and listener feedback. So continue to leave your comments and thoughts on the show if you're watching on YouTube or if you're listening on iTunes podcast or any of the podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at PoliticalBeatTV or email us at politicalbeattv@gmail.com. Tonight, the Dodgers are in game 6 against the Houston Astros. So go Dodgers. Hopefully tonight we will go into game 7 and win tomorrow. Don't forget to check out Survivor After Show tomorrow night on Wednesdays, the Scandal After Show on Sunday or on Thursdays, and get the latest on what you missed during the week at AfterBuzz TV with AfterBuzz Weekly on Fridays. Be sure to follow AfterBuzz TV on all social media to find out when your favorite shows are on. Thanks to Roger Wolfson for coming in, and Dr. Christopher Metzler. Leave your comments on YouTube and subscribe to Political Beat on iTunes podcast, and we'll see you. Happy Halloween. I'm not dressing up tonight.
I think I'm scary enough as is.
She's not. She's very pretty. Have a great weekend, guys. Bye.
From executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff, we would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
Buzz you later.
The views expressed herein are those of the host only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.